Hey everyone, it's Katie Couric, and I want to tell you about one of my new favorite podcasts. It's called A Really Good Cry with the amazing Roddy Devlukia, a plant-based chef, entrepreneur, and now a podcast host who will guide you through a journey of self-discovery, one tear at a time. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Roddy Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everyone. Today, I am reporting to you from my parked car on a side street in Upper Manhattan. Now, why on earth is that? Well, it's because I just stepped out of Amy Schumer's apartment, which sounds like the name of a new TV show, Amy Schumer's Apartment. And I wanted to tell you all about our conversation while it's still fresh in my mind. Amy Schumer, the comedian, actress, writer, and now Broadway star, is the latest lady in our Wonder Women series. It was just us gals in her apartment. Yes, I'm pretty excited about that for our chat. But as you heard, Brian already barged into the ads. And don't worry, Brian will be back again during the break and credits as well. And of course, for next week's episode too. As for my interview with Amy, we had a lot to cover. She's been so productive since bursting onto the national stage back in 2007 when she was a contestant, believe it or not, on NBC's Last Comic Standing. Turned out pretty well for her. Amy made her mark in stand-up with her signature brand of taboo-busting and unapologetically raunchy comedy. And to give you an idea, her first stand-up special was called Mostly Sex Stuff. Now, more recently, she's also flexed her skills in acting, producing, and writing. Of course, I love Trainwreck. You probably did, too. She starred in movies, penned a best-selling memoir, The Girl with the Lower Back Tattoo. Funny, huh? And she's won awards for her hit sketch series on Comedy Central. And if that weren't enough, she's fresh off her Broadway debut in a play written by Steve Martin called Meteor Shower. Fair warning, Amy is known for being a little bit bawdy, and to kick things off, I decided to clear the air and revisit the time that Amy full-on pranked me. Now, it's probably a bit R-rated, so you may not want to listen to this episode with the kids, especially if you haven't had the talk yet, or maybe even if you have. We have so much to talk about,
yeah.
But first, I think, Amy, we should give people a little bit of the backstory of our last encounter, because you have utilized me in some of your acts.
You were such a great sport, and, like, I'm such a fan of yours anyway, and I'm very grateful to your work, for real. Like,
thank you.
Yeah, I feel a little choked up that you're here in my home, so thank you.
Thank you, Amy.
And you just were such a great sport.
Let's tell the story.
Okay, we'll tell the story. It was at... It was after the Glamour Women of the Year Awards. We were at this, like, after party. And at our table, it was
Stephen Colbert,
Mindy Kaling. And we were next to each other. And your husband arrived. And you were, like, you know, kind of like, oh, my God, he wasn't embarrassed. He's crashing. Like, you were, you know,
actually, I was kind of aggravated with him.
Oh,
because
okay.
He, you know, I didn't invite him. I love you, John. But he wasn't invited. And
crashed.
He sort of just showed up. And
yeah.
I was like, wait a second. What is my husband doing here? Because mm-hmm. It's kind of, even though Stephen was at our table, it's kind of a girl power thing.
Totally.
And it's such
not a, bring your not hubby
really.
Situation.
It's not really a plus one.
Yes.
And so John walked in. And I was like, oh, my God. what's going on? My husband's here. Right. So I got up because he made a beeline to carry Russell.
I remember that. Yeah. You know? He's like, oh, no.
He loves the American. Yes, so, yeah. He loves Carrie Russell. So I thought, oh, I better go say hi to him or he's going to leave this party with Carrie Russell. So I got up and I left my phone on the table.
You left your phone on the table unlocked.
Unlocked. And so
that's on you.
You very cagily.
I, without thinking about it and without consulting anyone, just picked up your phone. I saw that you had just texted your husband. And then I text him saying, I want to have anal tonight. And the rest is history. So it was so funny because from my perspective, so I kind of like, I go, oh my God, because I just have these impulses to do like, what's the worst thing I could do right now? And then I kind of check with people to be like, oh, it's okay. So I go, Mindy, and I show Steven. And they're just, Mindy was like very alarmed as she should have been. And Steven just fell on the floor laughing. And then you and your husband came back over the table kind of like soon after. And we're like, we're leaving. And it just, from my perspective, I was like, well, this is absolutely hilarious. And then I don't know if you
and
just.
And by the way, yes, I thought it was super funny too. Because it actually sounded like something that I would do like to a friend. Because I was constantly pranking people like that on computers at work. When they left their computer open, I would do, you know, write funny messages to people. But And I thought it was really funny. Yeah. My husband actually is really funny and has great sense of humor. He thought it was funny too. And we laughed about it. But then, how long later?
A few months later, I guess. I kind of started.
I think you were publicizing Trainwreck.
Was it Colbert?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Okay. And so I talked about it.
We went to bed. And suddenly our phones were blowing up in the morning saying, oh my God, Amy Schumer was talking about you guys last night. And I was like, oh God. No. So I actually thought it was really funny. And I always was upset that you didn't include what John wrote back to me.
Oh, I didn't see.
What he texted back was, again?
Oh my gosh. If I had gotten that text, I would have cried laughing.
And I actually thought it was really funny. So you also used it on your HBO special.
Right, yeah.
Comedy special.
People really liked the idea of that prank, you know? They're
like, oh my God,
the sweetest, yeah.
But the only thing that hurt my feelings is you described when I came up to you at the Glamour Awards, and you said that I said something that I never would have said, like, I love funny. I love humor, but I don't think I said that.
I know. Well, this is where we have to agree to disagree. But just the same, I feel, you know, that was like a couple years ago. And I do feel like I take more responsibility for, you know, just being more careful with people's feelings and stuff.
No, that's okay. It just made me sound like such a tool. And I remember going up to you. That's
you're
okay.
not a tool.
Thank you.
One of the greatest people of all time.
Well, you're so sweet to say that. But I was like, I would never say I love humor. I'm sure I do remember going up to you and saying, hi, Amy. I just want to tell you I'm a big fan of yours.
Then you said I love humor.
I did not. I did not.
Oh, man. Okay.
But anyway, I still am trying to think of how to get you back. But
I know you will.
I actually thought it was really funny. We have so much to talk about in addition to your texting and pranking my husband, which is you've just finished doing Meteor Shower on Broadway, which I saw.
Oh, you
I thought you were fantastic
Thank
in
you.
It.
Thank you. Thanks
and,
for seeing
and
it.
And that was must have been an incredible experience for you because that was your first. I mean, you were on Broadway, Amy.
I got to do a Broadway play.
And
I know.
You were in a play written by Steve Martin.
It's still like really amazing to me that that happened.
So how did it all come about?
Well, my relationship with Steve was I did a play of his called Picasso at the Lapana Gil in college. And, you know, just this little student production and such a huge fan of his for, you know, like everyone else. And then I hosted this music show, this music talk show like 10 years ago, and he was on with his bluegrass band, and I had him sign my copy of the play, and I had him sign my copy of his autobiography, Born Standing Up, and I loved his music and everything, and he was really polite and sweet, and I got to do like a little bit with him for a promo on the show, and I left and I cried because I just couldn't believe I got to do a bit with Steve Martin. And then I became friends with Edie Brickell, and I went to see their musical Bright Star, and then just through friends, like, we just kind of kept running into each other. And then Steve and I became friendly and, you know, would hang out and he'd have some people over for dinner or whatever. And then he had this play and he said, I want you to read this play and I'd like you to play the role of Corky. And I was, like, already thinking of, yes, I'm doing this. I don't care. And then I read it and I was like, this is so fun and it'll be so great to do this role. And it's Steve Martin. And so, yeah, I said, what's the least amount of time I can do it? And I said, if you like that kind of team player energy, then, and they were like, yeah, you can do it for like 12 to 15 weeks. And we did it.
And
it
what
was so
it,
fun.
What was it like? Because, you know, watching you, you play, I mean, I love the character you play.
I wonder which show you were at. Did I yell at the audience at any point?
You didn't yell at the audience.
Oh, okay, good.
But you were sort of an exaggerated version of some version of yourself in a
sure.
way.
A different, both sides.
And
yeah.
and you, it was really fun and funny. But watching you, I thought, boy, and I think this every time I go see a Broadway show, this must be so hard. It must be so hard to remember all this stuff.
That's not a problem. No. No, I am. My sister tested my IQ once, and I tested in some categories as if I was a special needs person. And like in the low percentile for some things like word recognition, just reading down a fast list. And then some things I tested as a genius. And one of those was just memorization and short-term memory. So, you know, for stand-up, for anything, memorization is not a problem for me. But reading like a billboard as I'm driving down the street is, I see something different than what it says.
Really?
Yeah.
When you do stand-up, do you have any kind of prompter or any kind of cue cards that help remind you?
A set list with keywords.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So where is it in a
you
prompter?
You were on my set list for like a year. It said Katie Couric.
Anal sex.
As the closing bit. I mean, people, yeah, it was good enough that it was a closer.
So did this whet your appetite to do more Broadway?
Yeah, not right away.
More theater?
Oh, yes. I'm of the theater now. I'll do more theater, but not for a couple years. Yeah, I hope I do.
So let's talk about some of the other things that you've been up to. First of all, your schedule is crazy, and I love how you are doing a little bit of everything. So you're doing some stand-up stuff. Mm-hmm. You're doing another movie, I Feel Pretty, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Have you finished that movie?
Yeah, we're editing it.
You're editing it.
Post, yeah.
You did the great movie with Goldie Hawn, which was really fun.
Thank you.
And you did Trainwreck with Judd Apatow.
Yeah.
Or Toe.
Apatow. Or I've been saying it wrong for years.
Yeah, Apatow, who seems like an incredibly nice guy.
He's awesome. He's like the sweetest guy, especially with everything going on culturally. You really appreciate the people who've never made you uncomfortable. He has a special on Netflix, which is really good.
Really? Yeah. I've been seeing really some snippets of it on his Instagram. But Inside Amy Schumer, you're not doing right now, but you'd like to do more television in the future or something.
Yeah. It's like everything keeps evolving with the, you know, the options for how people can view content. So I'm open to everything.
Well, let's talk first about the movie that's coming out in June. Is that right?
Yeah.
So
it's like 4th of July weekend.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, you know, it came at a time where I was going to maybe do this other really big movie. And because with stand-up, I've made a lot of money. And so it's like I can really do stuff I care about now. I was like, you know, you're always afraid as a comic. You're like, is this my last set? Is this the last joke I'll ever write? Am I going to ever work again? So I was like really trying to sort of just make enough money so I could feel like I myself and my family and my friends were safe. You know, like if somebody got sick, I could take care of them. And then I was like, now I really want to, I'd love to still make money, but I want to do stuff that I feel like is really saying something. Which was sort of the only drawback with doing the play because it was so fun and exciting. But during this particular time, I really wanted to be giving all my energy to something that was like helping, you know. And even though people come and they laugh, it's like the crowds are all, you know, Broadway goers. I don't think it's a secret. It's all white, you know, pretty much wealthy people. Those tickets are expensive. So I felt a little bad about
being out of the conversation that was going on.
Yeah, so I was still, you know, in meetings for Time's Up and still active as an activist, but my main energy was going into that play. So I Feel Pretty came up, and the message was just exactly what I wanted to say to women. Because I'm interested in helping everybody that I can, but really I love women and want to focus on projects that empower them. And this movie is it's all about that. It's really fun and funny and relatable. But I think there's a really sweet message.
Well, can you tell me a little bit more about it and who else is in it?
Okay. So Michelle Williams is so funny in this movie. And Lauren Hutton plays a role. Naomi Campbell. Rory Scovel, who's a comedian who I've been friends with for 15 years. And he's so great in this movie. And A.D. Bryant who is on SNL.
I love her.
We became really, really close. And yeah, and Busy Phillips, and it's a really solid cast, and we had such a good time. And Emily Ratajkowski, and that's almost 100% not how you say her name, but you know who I mean.
I do.
Okay, so she's great. She's amazing. And it's about my character, Renee. She doesn't have particularly good self-esteem and just understands that people judge you how you look in this world right away. And we're trying to move further away from that, but that's the situation. And she just kind of longs to be, to have a better job, to go for these guys. But she just doesn't have the confidence. And I hit my head, I fall off a bike in SoulCycle, and then all of a sudden I see myself as an absolute supermodel. And everything changes, but actually nothing changes.
Yeah, the way you relate to the world.
Yes, it's a whole new life, a whole new person, and
that's so interesting because really the way you feel about yourself—if you feel like you're not attractive or something's going on with you or you've gained weight or whatever—it is amazing for women how much that can completely distort everything, right?
Yeah, you want to hide. It doesn't let you to live to your potential. And that's what we want from women the most right now. Just you have so much potential and you can do anything and we need you to lead. And they you know, feel held back. And I also have, I know we're going to talk about activism later, but Lisa Evans, who's a costume designer and a stylist, we started a foundation called Style Fund, and it's helping women learn how to dress for their bodies and like just kind of give them a formula. So if there is, you know, we started out with like prisoners going back to work and now it, or military veterans, but now it's really, we're trying to get develop it for all women, just because not everyone knows how to dress and they don't have access to, you know, help like you and I might. And it just really holds you back. But if you feel good and confident, then you're able to achieve more. So I think it's kind of all in line with the same message.
That's incredible. Are you working with some of the women you're helping with this this foundation?
Yeah, yeah.
And what is that like to see
really
kind of
emotional.
Them suddenly really change their whole outlooks?
Their energy completely shifts. It feels so good. And it's really emotional to see, you know, a mother of four who's just trying to reenter the workforce, who just, how do you can't do everything. How are you going to also, you know, with a low income job and kids and you need help, you know, most people need help. And so just having someone hand you the tools so you understand, okay, so if I wear this kind of scoop neck is good on me, and then if I just a cardigan, you know, and it can be from the Salvation Army who we partnered with for these events. You know, it doesn't have to be some fancy designer, and you can go into H&M and get like a $10 cardigan and make a pencil skirt. You know, we just help people dress for their comfort
level.
What
do they say when they...
They cry, and they're so excited, and they're proud to go home and show their kids and go out, and the energy just completely changes. You see a transformation in these women.
Time to take a quick break. We'll be back with Amy Schumer right after this. Hey everyone, it's Katie Couric, and I want to tell you about one of my new favorite podcasts. It's called A Really Good Cry with the amazing Roddy Devlukia, a plant-based chef, entrepreneur, and now a podcast host who will guide you through a journey of self-discovery, one tear at a time. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Roddy Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now? Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now back to my conversation with the one and only Amy Schumer. I want to talk about your activism regarding sensible gun laws mm-hmm. in a moment, and also, of course, what's been happening in Hollywood and sure. beyond. Mm-hmm. But first, I want to go back a little bit, Amy, and I know you get probably tired of talking about some of the same things, but I didn't know a lot about your life story. I didn't realize that you grew up here on the Upper East Side
oh, yeah.
of Manhattan. Uh-huh. And that I didn't know that your dad had been diagnosed with MS when yeah. you were very young.
Mm-hmm.
When you were, what, 9 years old?
Yeah, like 9 or 10.
And that you had gone from kind of a wealthy—
being rich to poor.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. And that suddenly you kind of had to make this adjustment
mm-hmm.
when your life changed. Your yeah. dad lost his business. He had to declare bankruptcy. You moved
right.
from a really sort of spacious
apartment.
A mansion
apartment. In the sky to yeah. a little—
to a little house,
yeah.
and then your folks got divorced. So I know that you still see your dad, and he's
yeah.
still
he has
still
a standing
here.
Lesson right now.
He does?
He's getting stem cells, so he's like, they put him in a contraption called a stander, and it helps him, like, remember how to stand, because he's been in a wheelchair for so long.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how do you think that impacted your outlook on life, and do you think that steered you toward comedy in a way?
Yeah. Are you guys worried about holding for sound? Hold for sound before Amy talks about her wheelchair dad. I think it made me like, you know, use humor as like a defense mechanism and keep everybody laughing also and keep myself laughing. And also just the reality of your parents are human beings and they're not invincible and they can get sick and they can have affairs and make mistakes. I learned that at too young of an age, and I think just the things I observed, I'm a comic, we are highly observational people, and I really took it all in and kind of understood the way the world worked with, for women and sex and like how little sort of power we had. And I think that's like been the basis of a lot of my stand-up up to this point.
It was, you mean watching your mom and dad?
Or? Yeah, I think like watching my mom and her dating and seeing my dad and his, he's, you know, I have a joke now in my stand-up that you just like assume everyone in a wheelchair is nice. Like we always like kind of smile and pay attention to someone in a wheelchair. But my dad is like a really like, he's like a womanizer, you know, he's like not the best person. I love him and he loves me. But you know, the way he was with women, like really objectified them and just like witnessing that at such a young age,
And wasn't faithful to your mom, I assume.
No, who knows? No, I don't think he was. But that's like the least of it.
Really?
yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. He maintains that he was, but I seriously doubt that. But they both made huge mistakes and weren't completely faithful. And
so it sounds like it was complicated.
Oh, I would say it's complicated.
No, but you know, but...
But then also, I feel bad saying that because there are people who have had it so much worse, you know? So I really don't feel like poor me. It's like, I'm grateful that I had two parents that loved me and we had a roof over our heads. And it was a really strange change to go from being rich to being pretty poor. But I wasn't getting hit. I wasn't getting raped. Like, it's just, people have it so much harder, I feel like.
But having said that, it wasn't ideal.
And no, it was not ideal. It was crazy.
And you kind of used humor. I mean, mm-hmm. were you always funny, Amy? When did you realize that, hey, I'm funny?
I was always funny.
Really?
I was like a kid.
Did you come out funny?
Yes. I mean, you know, don't you feel like you knew your children pretty quickly? Like, do you think those personality traits that you see early, do they maintain that?
I'm asking. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking.
I just know from my friends who have kids and then my niece, it's like, it was all there. Because now we have all these cell phone videos. We can look and be like, oh, she was already the boss and kind of, you know, came out like stomping around, pumping her fist in the air. It's like, yeah, I don't know. But yes, I was always funny and I always loved making people laugh.
And do you remember the first time you did stand up?
Yeah, I have a tape of it. It's awful.
Really?
Oh, God, yeah, it's terrible.
I mean,
my hair.
Really?
It's just like,
that was in New York, wasn't
it? Yeah,
it
was at Gotham Comedy Club, the old Gotham.
Do you remember the worst joke you told?
Yeah. It was about just what it's like to ride a crosstown bus in Manhattan and how it, I mean, it's not a good joke. I feel like, you know, inevitably I still want you to think it's funny, but just how like when you feel it like kind of like one of the tires deflate, you know, if they need to let somebody on who's like got something going on, and it was like, you know, this woman, she has like the plastic bags over the legs, you know, it was just about that and just how you know it's bad news when you feel the front tire deflate.
But clearly you got something from that experience and the audience got something from that experience.
Yeah.
Right?
I didn't have to go over stage fright, and they responded to me, and just the comics who were already making livings doing it, they kind of took me aside. They were like, you could be good at this if you wanted to. I wasn't good. But, you know, they were like, you can see if someone has the potential. I'm sure you see that in people. You're like, oh, this person's going to achieve a lot.
Yeah.
They're still living in a studio in Astoria right now, but they have big things coming their way.
And how do you perfect it? I mean, how do you then take your craft
mm-hmm.
and how do you sort of work on it and have it evolve and find sort of your sweet spot for the particular brand of observational humor that you decided to do?
I think just by doing it, you know, isn't that how it is also for journalists? It's like you know, people can give you advice, but you have to learn from these mistakes that you make and get braver from those and all the missteps. And then, you know, you just build up your confidence and I was open to learning, and I was such a fan of comedy. I feel really like humbled by it and just wanted to get really good and understood there was nothing more than experience. I just had to get as much stage time as was humanly possible. And I did. I did it, you know?
It seems to me that people initially had a hard time kind of putting you in a box.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I really feel for a lot of comics who, because people need to understand, you see a comic get on stage, you go, what's your deal? Okay, you're a Jewish gay guy from the Bronx. Okay, we understand that. So for me, I really kind of early on was like, I made some jokes about sex, and I was like, oh, actually, I don't know anybody else doing this right now. I don't know any other women that I've seen. I love female stand-ups and grew up with the biggest fan of them. Like, didn't really start loving male comics till later, but was like, I haven't really heard anyone talk that much about this in a way that was super realistic. And I mean, there's so many great, great comics who would mention it, but I was like, I have no problem talking about this. And I also, you know, in retrospect, think it was me trying to feel a little bit more control over my sexuality and asserting myself by sort of taking the air out of the behaviors that we do.
By saying, sort of with shock value a little bit?
For sure, at first it was shock value. I mean, you know, and it's just because I'm doing all these open mics where the comics are just waiting to go up. You have to surprise them into laughing. You can't just get a laugh from a joke being well-crafted. It's got to be. And so that's how I sort of made a name for myself just in the New York scene. And I just figured, like, okay, they're going to call me like the sex comic, and that's how I'll sort of lean into that and market myself that way. My first special was called Mostly Sex Stuff, and I've always felt like I was sort of, if I did the work, that I had the potential to do great things. And that just seemed like a stepping stone to it. I was like, I won't always be this. I won't always be known for this. But this is what I think I should do to get to the next step, whatever it is.
And why do you think? What do you think? There are so many talented people out there, but obviously you struck a nerve.
Uh-huh.
And there was something about you, the whole package.
Yeah.
Right? That people just gravitated toward.
Well, I'm sorry to ask you the same thing. But I mean, really, it's like, I don't know. I think it's just, I think it's opportunity meaning preparation, but I
also think it was, you were someone, and I, you know, whether we like the R word or not, but you were so relatable.
Uh-huh.
Because
I love that word.
I think that people felt like you could be their friend. Mm-hmm. You know, you were talking about things that bothered them. You were completely raw, authentic, and you know, honestly, you look normal.
Thank you.
You know, and you just seem fun and nice and normal.
Yeah.
And I think people don't see images like that, female images like that nearly enough.
Well, it's like this movie that's coming out, it's like, and when they were trying to figure out who was going to play Barbie, it's like, okay, we want it to be someone like relatable. And as far as actresses go, the ones that are, you know, in charge of sort of the box office of a movie, it goes like Rebel Wilson and Melissa McCarthy. And then, you know, body type wise, it goes to like Emma Stone. Like there's nobody really floating around the middle right now. I feel like I'm it right now. And I'm probably forgetting someone and I'll get some email like, what about me? I have saddlebags too. But but isn't that strange? You know, and a lot of people will think I'm like actually one of the stagehands on Meteor Shower. We'd been rehearsing for like a couple days and he came up. He's like, my wife and I are such huge fans. And I was like, thank you. And then we're talking and then I realize during the conversation that he fully 100% thinks that I'm Melissa McCarthy. And I just kind of was like,
Why?
He was like, you know, did you just see at the Emmys that Sean Spicer was there? And then they showed you. And I was like, oh. And then he was like, how long were you on SNL? And Melissa's never been a regular on SNL. So I'm like, not only does he not know who I am, but he also does not know that Melissa has never been a cast member on SNL. But he's really sweet. Smitty, I love you. And he was so like mortified just that he had my identity wrong. His wife got home and his wife was like, what? And he brought me a bottle of wine. I was like, hey, I'm flattered. She's hilarious. But, you know, it's like you just, Meghan Trainor, just anybody who looks at all similar, they just see like sort of a blonde plumpness and they say, they think we're all like one person. You know, Lena making Girls really inspired me. And, you know, the show Insecure and I got some heat for saying that it bothered me that Khloe Kardashian lost all that weight because I felt like she was like the relatable one. She already looked very thin to me before this transformation, not the pregnancy, but you know, and it was like that, you know, do whatever you want, feel healthy, feel great. But just as, you know, people, we all like look and judge celebrities. It was like, oh, like, come on, you were one of us. And so I just kind of, like Howard Stern once asked me, like, why don't you lose like 30 pounds? And I was like, I don't want to. I'll be hungry. And I lost some weight for Trainwreck. And I was like beauty and body, that's not my thing. That's not my currency. I feel beautiful and I feel strong and sexy, but that's not like, I'm not going to be the most beautiful girl. So I'm not going to try to market myself or get myself there. And I don't think that sends a good message. I think being like, and that's what I Feel Pretty is all about. It's just like, how about like not striving for some other version of yourself? Like, why not love what you've got going on right now rather than this, you know, eternal dissatisfaction?
I love that because I think, you know, you are addressing the insecurities that I think certainly
everyone.
I have had my whole life feeling never thin enough.
Right, which is, and if somebody else goes,
enough.
What, please.
No, I know. But I think we're so programmed that if you're not, you know, 20 pounds underweight, so you don't look, you know,
on
heavy
camera.
In a magazine or whatever.
Right.
And it's just so unrealistic. And when I see the clavicles, you know, that could cut an apple on the Oscars and everyone on every one of those women,
uh-huh.
I think gosh, no wonder we've been so, it's like Pavlovian.
Yeah.
So that if you see someone normal, you go from they look good to they look fat.
Right.
And they're just normal.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's,
but how do,
I hate
how
that
do you change that, really?
By doing it, you know? Like in this movie, I have a scene where it's PG-13, but I'm naked. You can see from the back. And then also a scene where I dance with my shirt off. And it's like, I'm not letting them retouch anything. You know, I'm like, don't touch it. This is, you know, that's against the point. And I feel excited about that. And I feel like these changes are happening.
You have a very funny skit about that on your show or in your stand-up where you say when you pose naked, you talk about a photo shoot with Annie Leibovitz, where you said the last thing you want people to say when they see a naked photo of you is,
wow, she's so brave. You're like, what? You know, but whatever. But I understand it. And it's also, you know, I love watching all – I love The Bachelor and I love reality shows and all these Real Housewives. They all – The Bachelor, I was like, what would happen if they had like an actual – like a girl who looked like somebody you were friends with and not like these like little tiny bodies? And even though those girls are beautiful – and again, I don't want to thin shame anybody either, but it's like the example that young women are seeing, like what are they witnessing? They see – the Kardashians, who I think have actually done a lot of, especially Kim got involved with sensible gun laws, which is really cool. And I think that they're cool. They're sisters and they can be funny. But their role models are all these shows. It's like Basketball Wives. It's like just people get TV shows because they like had a kid with a hip hop artist or something. This isn't like what we want young women to be aspiring to. So, I don't remember what I'm saying.
I think you're talking about sort of the role models out there and that we're talking about how you change it. And how you change it is give opportunities to...
Right. And to see, you know, women whose bodies look a little more realistic for like actual life who don't... Because most people can't afford a chef and a trainer and to be starving and have somebody like bring over your like little pile of seeds that you're allowed to eat in the morning. And I can afford those things, but I'm like, I'm not doing that. I don't want to like, because those people aren't happy either. I have some friends who are like, I don't want to hang out today. I won't be able to enjoy it. I have to be hungry today. And that's like totally typical for
really
a lot of actresses. And it's like, still, let's, come on, enough. But it's funny. I go to the award shows and I try to look my best and I look like, you know, how the costume designers look. And I feel proud about that.
That's good.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about what's happening in Hollywood since, you know, obviously there's this seismic shift for women.
Yeah.
And it's been
for all women
fascinating to watch and exhilarating and also kind of mind-blowing on many levels. And I'm curious, when this started to spill out, when these stories started to come out and women started standing up and speaking out, what did you think?
I thought... I'm hearing a lot of these stories of these survivors of these incidents, and I feel like horrible for them and really proud of them for coming forward, and also like that none of that happened to me. I think the stuff that's happened to all of us, especially with the kind of the newer accusations about just coercion, you know, where people are like, oh, that's a gray area. But I loved Samantha Bee's piece on that. She just did this monologue about it. Everything doesn't have to be rape. You know, it's not like rape or it's fine. I think a lot of us have gotten so used to that behavior of a guy being like, come on, like at a younger age, especially like in college, I feel like that was, you know, a quarter of my hookups. Like they see what they can get out of you. And please, you know, imagine, like, I don't know who wants to be with someone who's not interested in being with them, but that kind of like wearing you down and or, you know, being in an uncomfortable situation and being like, oh, well, I got myself here. So now I have to have sex with this guy sort of to get out of here.
I think there's been a real sea change in especially younger women and consent and sort of how it's being framed in college. That's making them rethink and forcing older women to rethink sort of the dynamics that go on in an encounter.
Right.
Right? And so for me, it's been kind of a little bit of a mind shift to, because I think consensual is consensual.
Right.
But then, of course, now we're talking about unequal power dynamics and how is it really consensual when someone has so much sway over your future and
career.
Your career.
Yeah.
And then there's sort of the consensual, well, having nothing to do with professional relationships, like the Aziz Ansari story, which I've been thinking a lot about and trying to understand kind of the dynamics there, because that was very interesting to me. Younger women thought this situation was wrong.
Yeah.
And I think many older women thought, why don't you get up and leave?
Right.
So where do you come down on that whole thing?
I'm in the middle where I'm saying, what a great thing that there's this change with this generation who I think we're going to learn from this. And, you know, Samantha Bee did that whole piece on, like, no, like, I don't think anyone wants to see Aziz's career ruined or his life ruined or anything like that, but that's where people's minds go. They go, is it, does he deserve this? And it's really not about that. I think it's about expressing and showing women that that behavior is not okay, and that you, not only can you leave, but you need to leave, because then the women who come after you, you're leaving a mark for them too. So it's not just about your own encounter. You have to also think about, if you don't say to somebody, this made me super uncomfortable and it's not okay, which is a really uncomfortable thing. And sometimes you go, oh, he's a nice guy. I just want to leave. I don't want to make it uncomfortable. But if you don't really lay your boundaries out, then you're leaving it open for the women who come after you. And so I think a lot of women feel really bad that they've been complicit with things, but we didn't know not to be. And I think now there's kind of no excuse. And if you have a doctor that makes you uncomfortable, or you get a massage, or you have a date with someone and they coerce you in a situation like the Aziz one, I don't think there's any sort of, you know, criminal charge. But I think that it's good for this, for everybody to learn that that behavior's not acceptable. It's not a crime, but it's not cool. And it can still really mess with a woman.
So is it the overall presumptuousness of men who are in that situation? Because I also want women to have agency and to stand up. But I also appreciate that it's difficult.
Yeah.
And it must be confusing for men too.
Well, that's what I am thinking about right now. That's why I kind of want to come up with a little bit of a code of conduct for us as women, because I think a lot of men are really confused right now, you know, and are like, wait, this has been cool for so long. And, you know, our dynamic at the office or at the gym or whatever, it's been like, you know, we kind of flirt. And some people, we've all done this. We just flirt back with them so it's not uncomfortable. Or maybe we have some sort of an advantage, you know, oh, this guy has feelings for me, so I kind of prey on that. And we've all been there, and we kind of can't do that anymore. And we need to explain it to men and to other women that we need to be teaching each other the kind of behavior that's acceptable. And so when something comes up, to say, that makes me really uncomfortable. Or, you know, just what you're willing to accept. And that those are the hard conversations, but we just can't let things continue the way that they've continued, because there's so many different levels of it. Something like what happened with Aziz, which, you know, and he's been my friend, and I feel for the woman. I identify with all the women in these situations. I kind of, my mind doesn't go right. Even if it's my friend, I don't go, oh, but he's a good guy. I think, what would it feel like to have been her, you know? And
well, you were in some ways her, because you've had a situation that you talked about in your book.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, I've been flat out raped. But I mean, but there are so many other kinds of sex. There's so much other sexual misconduct. I mean, every woman I know, every woman in this room, we've all had these experiences and I think in some ways this current climate, it brings these things up and you go, God, none of that was okay. You know, and I'm someone who journaled. I kept journals and I read back and I go, I just feel so bad for that girl. You know, why didn't you get up and leave? And sometimes you do. And sometimes you just do it.
Do you think that the conversation will you know, right now it seems like a volcano erupting and sort of this fury and rage and frustration and this kind of ickiness yeah. that has been sort of bubbling beneath the surface is now kind of exploding. And women are talking about this, and men, I think, are not part of the conversation right now.
Uh-huh.
How do you see this movement evolving? Like evolving?
I think a lot of men are anxious to be part of the movement because they want to help, and they're good people, and, you know.
And I think they also want to understand maybe what they, behavior that they felt comfortable
yeah.
and why it wasn't okay.
Right, and it's up to us to teach them. And I do mean women. I think they're open to it. People, you know, a lot of the men in my life are open to self-reflection and evolving, and I am. And so how can we be better at teaching them? And, you know, there's some behavior where you go, that's just clearly insanely wrong, and
right.
you should just be in jail. Like, oh gosh, I'm so proud of all those gymnasts who stood up to, and how great was that judge who
right.
went, I'm signing your death sentence, and these women are not victims, they're survivors. And yeah, it's kind of up to us to teach them right now so that things can be different for the next generation. I think we'll see some movement. You know, like I get to spend a bunch of time with Gloria Steinem, and this is a really exciting time for her. And they had to fight to get their own magazine, and people weren't listening. Now we have the internet. We have like a real voice, and people are really paying attention. And it's just so across all industries. It's like, and most of the women at Time's Up, like, you know, we're like, okay, let's take care of our house first, which I think Shonda Rhimes said at a meeting. But you know, there's so many levels under sort of what our house is. It's like the stunt women, the crew women, but set up so that women in all industries, in these low-paying jobs, women who work at hotels and farm workers and people who work in the service industry, it's rampant. It's really frightening. And I think there's like this big change happening, and I don't think it'll burn out because the people, everyone's really fired up about just giving their time and energy because it's just so important and essential.
Do you think this would have happened if Donald Trump hadn't been elected?
No. No, I don't. So, I'm a Hillary girl myself, but if we want to find any sort of a silver lining, if he hadn't bragged about grabbing pussies, we probably wouldn't be protecting ours so much right now.
You have been involved in this even before this movement happened because you've spoken out about pay inequity.
Yeah.
When you got your Netflix special mm-hmm. and found out Dave Chappelle and Chris Rock were making
uh-huh.
a certain salary that was really almost twice as much
it
as
was
yours.
Like about, yeah, it was like twice as much.
You said, excuse me.
Yeah, well, again, I wasn't like trying to go viral with news for that, and that news didn't kind of break till later on. I thought those guys are absolute legends. They're two of my best friends also, and they deserve every penny they got paid for that those specials, and you know, and I'm really proud of them. And also I don't think with where I am sort of in the zeitgeist right now that I deserve half of what they're getting. I think I'm going to ask for more, and I asked by myself. I didn't pay anybody any commission on the extra money I received. And, and there was so much. I have these, and I'm sure you probably do too, just with working on gun laws and with the nature of my stand-up, I have like organized trolls who go against me, and they get my movies voted down on Rotten Tomatoes and all this stuff. And with
Lovely.
The special, yeah, what a treat. But I'm just like, I really, truly don't care.
But at first, I'm sure it was pretty unnerving.
Oh, of course. And then you learn like, yeah, you're like, oh God, you're so afraid. And then it's like, I'm just going to keep doing my thing. And they're doing their thing. And, you know, but so there was so much controversy with this special and people really looking to hate on it. And I'm really very proud of it. And I got nominated for, I directed it, so I got nominated for directing it.
Congratulations.
I'm up against the Oscars, so I don't think I'll beat the Oscars. But I thought, you know, it's not that cute. And when it comes out in the news, oh, that wasn't enough money for you, you should be grateful. I just thought that's not the message that we need to be sending right now. It's not about that. It's not, you know, my last season of my TV show, I felt like kind of underpaid the whole time.
Right. And so you went to Comedy Central too.
Yeah. And I was like, hey, I know that these guys with similar shows to me are getting more money than me. And so finally, when they gave me more money, I donated 90% of it to the crew who had been working with me the whole time. Just to be, it's not about that, you know. Sure, right. Money's awesome, and I love fun and drinking nice wine, but I donate so much, and it really for me was just about like it's not fair. Like I had a book deal back in the day, and I was like, no, I think it'll be worth 10 times more than this. And I backed out and nobody wanted me to. And, you know, you got to like stand your ground. And that's why I really want to support just women in any job fighting for equal pay. And it can be really hard. I know it's different industries. It's easier said than done. But if I can support, I want to. And I want to send that message.
But it's so typical because as a woman, if you do make demands, if you do ask for equality,
mm-hmm.
you're automatically seen as difficult, bitchy.
You're vilified.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that's because of how we've been conditioned to act.
Yeah.
And I think that...
you're a boss.
Right.
But a woman.
I do think women, one of the great, aspects of this movement is I think we're going to equip women with hopefully the confidence and the power to make demands.
Yeah.
And to not typecast them when they do.
Right.
But I think our society really, and I think probably that's why you got so much pushback.
Uh-huh.
A man, first of all, a man wouldn't have had to do that.
No.
But secondly, if he had, everyone would have been like, yeah, right on.
Get your money, son. Yeah. But for me, it's like, I anticipated that, and it didn't come out till like, you know, a month after it came out or something, after the special came out, I think. And I'm proud of my business sense, and I think another message that we want to send is that there's power in numbers, and so that's why, you know, I don't even know Kat Sattler, you know, like I probably spoke to her on a carpet or something once, but was a correspondent at E, and I just like heard about her not getting offered equal pay, and it was like, well, let's stand up for this woman and fight for her. Let's stand up for each other, you know. And right now it's like within our business, but we're joining forces with all these other industries so that it's, you know, it's a global thing. They want to start a Time's Up Kenya.
It's exciting.
It's awesome.
But, you know, Amy, I through the years, you have gotten, I think because you are comfortable in your own skin and who you are, but how do you handle it when people attack you relentlessly?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think everyone probably is attacked relentlessly these days
with social media. Not to the level that
with so much vitriol, whether it's about, you know, anything from soup to nuts. It could be about something
my appearance,
you said.
Or about money or.
Right. Or it could be about your position on gun laws.
Right.
I mean, so that can be very debilitating, demoralizing, and psychically depleting, I think.
Right.
How do you handle it?
I just early on, like I did the roast of Charlie Sheen, and after one of my jokes got a lot of pushback, and I knew then, and I know now that it's not actually personal. I think success really annoys people, and when somebody's making money and they're doing well, you can't help it. You just want them to fail, and I don't blame anyone for that.
What is it about
that? I don't know. We're all
nature.
Like that. We love to build.
They call it the tall poppy syndrome
in Australia. Right. Nobody's like allowed to get famous there.
Well, when they do, they just can't wait
to chop you down. Right. So I think it's that that's just sort of resentment. Instead of putting energy toward working on yourself, I think it's really easy to just vilify somebody else. And so that doesn't feel personal to me. Any feelings like that, that's more about the person who has those feelings than it is about me. And these controversies that have come up, and, you know, I've had many, like people are waiting to tear you down and burn you at the stake when you're in this position. And some of them I've really learned from, and I still have so much I need to learn. And I really don't take it personally. And it never makes me feel like I'm a bad person. You know,
did you always feel that way, or did you learn to not take it personally?
No, I learned early on. I learned like 10 years ago. And so since then, it feels bad when it's like affecting work, you know, like if I'm getting picketed or something, like it's like, oh God, this is going to push us back an hour or something like that. But it doesn't hurt my feelings anymore. It hasn't for like 10 years.
Do you read it?
Like if there's like a big thing going on, I'll like check it out. But it makes me laugh. Like, I don't know. Yeah, I really feel like I know who I am, and I love my friends and family and like the people I'm close to, and I'm respected by the comedians that I love and respect. And I feel really fortunate. And if I let myself get brought down by these, you know, like controversies that I know don't actually like that what my intentions were, or, you know, if I hurt someone, I would feel horrible, you know, but, you know, like, and I think there's a lot of, when it comes to race, like, I now on my projects have an inclusion rider. So there has to be a certain number of people of color or people with disabilities or something, you know, filling these roles that's like, and this is a big part of Time's Up where we're all encouraging people to do this now. So that the cast is like more reflective of the actual population. And I've been like accused of being racist over the years, and I just am so not, but I also recognize there's room to grow, and I just want to do my best to empower women and people of color. But I also understand it's like, it's gotta be really annoying. Like I could see myself getting vilified in, you know, different communities for whatever reason, but my intentions are just so to truly include everyone. And so,
do you ever worry that this heightened sensitivity and this kind of greater consciousness about not offending people that the pendulum perhaps has swung too far, and that you feel like you're walking on eggshells and someone's going to be upset if you make a joke about this or that? Or do you think it's a good thing? Or are you, again, somewhere in
the middle?
Between.
No, I do think it's a good thing. You know, jokes that I made 10 years ago, I wouldn't dream of making now. And that was just kind of right for me at the time. And culturally, things were different. And, you know, like, guys were telling, like, a lot of rape jokes. I had some jokes about rape. And that's just, that just is so unacceptable now. And just, I feel more of a responsibility because my voice is heard more now. So I want to do a good job of not hurting anyone's feelings and just, you know, sort of moving the needle in the right way. So I don't think it's a bad thing, this oversensitivity. And there'll still be comics that don't, you know, care, and they'll just say whatever they want if you want that. But I'm not interested in doing that personally. I don't feel held back. I don't feel, you know, there's some things like that's just for your friends. And we can always just joke with our friends. I'm friends with, like, the dirtiest comedians alive. And we say horrible stuff to each other that if it got out, we'd be toast, you know? But everybody has those conversations with their friends and family. But what I am willing to say on stage, it's not, like, a self-preservation thing. It's just I'm not interested in it, and it just doesn't feel like the right time.
I want to, before we go, talk to you about how you got involved in gun activism.
Yeah.
I remember very well when that happened at that movie theater where Trainwreck was playing. That was in Louisiana?
Yeah, Lafayette, Louisiana, and July 23rd. Yeah.
Two young women were killed, a 21-year-old woman and I believe a 33-year-old woman.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about them.
Macy and Jillian.
You know, and then, you know, these things happen and I don't know. Today I was thinking about how quickly people forget about tragedies and move on. I was thinking about their families when I was getting ready to talk to you because I thought, who remembers that? Who remembers them?
Me.
You.
Yeah, and their families. I think about them all the time. I kind of keep them with me and any, like, accomplishments or anything. And I just always mention them. I dedicate every special to them now, and just to kind of keep them alive in myself and just in the ether.
Is that what set you off on this path to really try to do something about how many guns are in this country?
And yeah, yeah.
Was that something that you were passionate about before then?
No, not at all. I really had no information before then. And I miss those days because it's just, you know, it's really upsetting. Just how sort of lax the gun laws are, and how easy it is for somebody who's on, you know, a no-fly list, or somebody who's mentally ill or has been convicted of being an abuser, like, it's still pretty easy to get a gun. And yeah, and these shootings, they're every new one, they're like the news cycle there's a new thing the next day, and we push and we get into Congress's face and we go, because so many politicians are getting money directly from the NRA, as you know.
Are you discouraged?
But then I look at the people who work at Everytown for gun safety, and, you know, Julianne Moore and I are both on the board there, and then just going out to these events and meeting people. I just, before the Las Vegas shooting, a couple months before, I'd been in Vegas to meeting with their chapter for Everytown, just listening to people's stories about how gun violence has affected them. They're just so heartbreaking that you're just like, even if I move this, just I can help move this just a little bit in my lifetime, that'll be worth it. And I just, you know, everybody just refuses to give up. And I believe it'll take a long time, but I think there'll be like a real change. I have to believe that.
As we look ahead, and knowing that you were a passionate Hillary Clinton supporter, How are you surviving the era of Trump?
I just feel so much better than I think we all did a year ago. I think a lot of all my friends were just like in a depression for a year. Especially those first few days after the election, like it was just like the most painful, like worst. I would say it was second to getting the news that Macy and Jillian had been killed. It was just, I just felt angry, and there's got to be a place for that, you know, for women to express anger. And yeah, we just needed a little time for it to really mess us up and realize how bad things still are in the world. You know, we got blessed with this Obama era, these great 8 years we were given, and then just to be like an about face in the wrong direction in what feels like every single area. To me, I just feel that he is a huge, annoying setback. And that's like a very, you know, that's incredibly reductive. And I don't think that anybody who is afraid of deportation right now, like living in terror, is would look at it that way. But that's what I'm trying to keep it that way in my sights, to keep myself encouraged that, you know, we can all really work together and make change. And women wanting to lead and women wanting to run for Congress. And we're seeing so much changing, just, you know, with politics, and I believe we'll get the House back this year. That's my hope.
And in a way, he has been a real catalyst, hasn't he? I mean,
yeah.
You mentioned a silver lining, but it seems as if people have been, you know, woken up from their complacency.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Just like I'm not mad at internet trolls, I'm not even mad at Trump. He's just like King Joffrey. Like, he's just been empowered by people who didn't, I feel like they didn't understand. And I wrote like a really aggressive tweet or Instagram the day after he won. I was just furious with these people. Like, do you understand what you've done? You know, the people who elected him. And I think a lot of them have real regrets and didn't understand.
But do you have compassion for some of these voters who felt like Hillary Clinton was not speaking to them?
Yeah.
And I was thinking about it, and I think that deplorable comment was probably really damaging to her candidacy.
Yeah, I think it was too. Like, there's all these, like, you know, we can read what happened. But it's, you know, it just doesn't that sound funny that he's now saying these shithole countries, and you know, he's paying a, he paid off a porn star after Barron was born. Like, it's just the, if you put them on a chart next to each other, it's just, it's hilarious the things that she's been vilified for versus the things that we're just not even paying attention to anymore.
There was a funny skit on SNL.
Yeah.
That they had a game show, Does It Matter?
Oh, yeah. Jessica Chastain hosted it. She did such a great job. Yeah. Yeah. And it was like, we can't even keep up. It's not even interesting anymore. You know, when someone's like, did you hear what Trump said today? I'm just like, I don't, can I skip it? Like, can I just, can I sit this one out? Yeah.
But all in all, you're feeling very optimistic about the future and about the state of the country versus a year ago.
I really am. I think people are understanding that the change has to come from them. If you have it in you to run for office or to go to a meeting or to start like a chapter of something in your town where you can try to help get the word out for people to vote, just people didn't know what they were capable of, and I think they're feeling more empowered. And I think we really are about to experience even more change for the better.
Do you think you'd ever run for office?
I don't know. There's got to be a sex tape of me out there somewhere. Can you be in an office if you have a sex tape? Yeah, I don't know. If I thought that would be helpful and I would do a good job, it's the same as like a role in a movie. I don't want to do it if there's someone out there who could do it better than me, but if I ever felt like I could do a good job and be helpful, I would.
Because Chuck Schumer, of course, is your second cousin.
Yeah.
They used to say the most dangerous place to be on Capitol Hill was between Chuck Schumer and a camera.
Oh, that's hilarious. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's not afraid of the spotlight. Yeah, I'm really proud of him. And I know, you know, what's been happening lately, it's like, it just seems
was
like...
Was that a miscalculation in your view?
Of what?
The shutdown and the DACA and sort of the Democrats' position on that?
A miscalculation? Like,
yeah, well, some people think it's really hurt the Democrats.
Right.
But I don't know yet.
I don't know. You know, I'm watching the news like everybody else.
And
I'm reading like what Chuck's kind of press releases are about it. And, you know, I know him. I love him. I believe he's the greatest intentions. And I believe he has a plan. And I hope Mitch McConnell wasn't lying. I'm hoping the same things that everybody's hoping.
Anyone you like for 2020?
You.
Come on.
Well, we found out Oprah's not interested. So how about Shonda Rhimes? I'd vote for her.
Well, I love talking to you, Amy Schumer.
Me too. Thanks for coming here.
Can I come over without a microphone sometime?
Anytime.
And we can talk and
we can talk
really
real shit. We can really talk shit.
You can make a lot of jokes about me. You can even talk about anal sex. But don't say...
that you said you love humor?
Yes.
I'll never say that again.
Thank you. Thanks to our roving podcast production team for helping us record at Amy's pad for this one. It's kind of cool. I was in Amy's pad. That's Gianna Palmer, our producer, Jared O'Connell, our audio engineer, assistant producer, Nora Ritchie.
Thanks also, as always, to Beth DeMaz and Emily Bina over at Katie Couric Media.
And Allison Bresnick, who represents on social media.
Katie and I are the executive producers around here. Mark Phillips wrote our theme music. Please feel free to send your questions, feedback, and guest ideas to us over at comments@couricpodcast.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail, as always, at 929-224-4637.
That does it for us today, everyone. We'll be back next week with our latest Wonder Woman, Laverne Cox. Bye, Brian.
Talk to you next week, Katie.
Hey, everyone, it's Katie Couric, and I want to tell you about one of my new favorite podcasts. It's called A Really Good Cry with the amazing Roddy Devlukia, a plant-based chef, entrepreneur, and now a podcast host who will guide you through a journey of self-discovery, one tier at a time. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Roddy Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like $1 million.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
Is he breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.